This call is being recorded.
Hi, my name is John Richardson. I am speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Wednesday, September the 18th, 2019, and we've got a very interesting discussion happening today. My guests are in no particular order, Anthony Perrant of IRS Medic, and I've had the pleasure of being on a number of his podcasts over the years. Thank you very much for attending on this, Anthony. And secondly, well-known to all the accidental Americans of the world, Keith Redmond, an American Overseas Global Advocate. And this is actually a very important but narrow topic today. We are going to talk about the problem that accidental Americans are having in general, and specifically in the context of the what's been getting a lot of media attention, the possibility of their bank accounts being closed by banks that they use in the countries where they actually live, if you can imagine. Now, the reason that I say this is a narrow sort of podcast and topic is that I think it's important to make a distinction between accidental Americans and Americans abroad, and what exactly would be the difference. Americans abroad generally are people who identify as being American citizens. They may or may not be tax compliant. They may or may not be tax compliant. Mostly they are. But for the accidental Americans, some of them didn't even know they were American citizens. So for them, they're almost never in tax compliance, and they're faced with the problem that the United States is taxing citizens, and they define citizens as anybody born in the United States unless they've relinquished U.S. citizenship. Hence, we have a gigantic problem with that group of people. So we're going to talk about that as an issue today. All right. Let's begin with the whole issue of whether somebody is, in fact, a U.S. citizen. Because remember that this whole thing arises. This whole thing arises largely because of FATCA. And in countries with FATCA IGAs, the non-U.S. banks are essentially hunting for people who are U.S. citizens as defined by the United States. So we begin with the whole issue of is somebody in fact a citizen or not? And Keith, why don't we begin with you? Any particular thoughts on that? How does somebody know if they're a U.S. citizen?
Well, I think it just depends. Sometimes somebody knows that they're a U.S. citizen when they get their letter from their bank stating that they have been identified as a U.S. person because their U.S. place of birth. Many times, that is the first indication.
And this comes as a surprise to a lot of people, does it, who have never lived in the United States?
It does come to a surprise for a certain number of people where, for example, they've never had a U.S. passport. They left when they were in diapers, literally, from the United States with non-U.S. parents, and they've moved back to the country from which their parents come, for example, France or Germany or Italy. And fast forward 30 years, and they get a letter from their bank, their de facto letter, stating mm-hmm. that they're a U.S. person.
Or accusing them of being a U.S. person because of a U.S.
Exactly.
place of birth. The letter does allow them to self-certify they're not, though. I mean, we'll get to that in a minute. Anthony, do you get many people calling you in a panic saying, oh, my God, I just learned that I might be an American citizen?
Yeah, it's a common thing that happens a lot that people that they don't even know. And, you know, just kind of thinking of the question is like, how do you really know? Because that is the way that people find out a lot of times. The bank tells them, but how does the bank know? What's the database of U.S. citizenships that we go to verify whether or not we're a U.S. person? And, you know, I'm kind of questioning myself exactly how do they know they're right and where does this go? And how is it possible that somebody made a mistake? And that's just something to think about, that there really isn't. And as we kind of, I think as we kind of explain some of the things that go on is just sort of these gaps between the agencies and how they communicate to each other. You know, we're going to be talking about Social Security numbers, which is a Social Security administrated sort of artifact, not an IRS artifact. And so how do they go back and forth? But yeah, overall, John, yeah, people wind up being very surprised to find out that they're U.S. persons.
Right. Well, I think what's happening in the context of FATCA, as Keith points out, it is the U.S. place of birth. But you know, a U.S. place of birth would mean that somebody would start out life as a U.S. citizen, but it's entirely possible they may have performed a relinquishing act along the way and might not, in fact, be a U.S. Citizen, which is why, you know, all the IGAs allow for a self-certification to explain why you're born in the United States and you have renounced or, you know, you've relinquished U.S. citizenship without having a CLN, right? So, you know, this is quite interesting because, I mean, I live in Toronto, Canada, where there's just, you know, an unbelievable number of U.S. born people who immigrated to Canada, particularly during the 60s and 70s, became Canadian citizens. You know, I think in many cases, they certainly believed and tended to lose U.S. citizenship. They just never got a CLN, a certificate of loss of nationality. And now, you know, they're accused of being an American citizen. I mean, what would you advise somebody in a situation like that, Keith? Somebody says, this can't be. I became a citizen of France or Germany. I was told I was losing my U.S. citizenship.
Well, to be honest with you, I have not dealt with individuals like that. I've dealt with people who have been a citizen of the country of their parents since birth. So I have rarely dealt with somebody who has committed a relinquishing act, if you will. The only thing that has remotely come close to that is an accidental American who may have had a U.S. passport from the get-go, left the United States in diapers, and then their parents never renewed that U.S. passport. So it just fell by the wayside, and they moved forward as a French citizen or a German citizen, and that was it. They never renewed their passport. They knew nothing about it, mm-hmm. again, yeah. until the FATCA letter came.
Yeah, that in itself, just living your life is not in and of itself a relinquishing act. Do you encounter that sort of scenario in your practice, Anthony? Somebody says, you know, I'm really confused. I mean, you know, I believed up and swear upside down, sideways, and diagonally that by becoming a citizen of country X, Y, or Z, that I'd relinquished my U.S. citizenship. How is it that I can be somehow resurrected as a U.S. citizen today?
Well, I think the thing is because we mangle the law. Because you're right. If you are, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of countries, you're not allowed to have dual citizenship. That's not a thing. And so becoming a citizen of another country by default, and I think being a citizen of another country and acting as if you were is a relinquishing act. If we actually were going to apply the law correctly, it's just that, you know, the courts just mangle the law left and right. So I think that's really the answer. It's just a misapplication of the law because you really shouldn't be a U.S. citizen. When you think about what citizenship is and when you think of what the oath of citizenship is, it's, you can't have a dual. It doesn't really work like that.
Yeah. There is, interestingly, though, there are different definitions of citizenship for nationality purposes and tax purposes. And
yeah,
prior to 2004, a loss of citizenship for nationality purposes would have meant a loss of citizenship for tax purposes. From 2004 on, through a series of two statutes, really, one, they created a concept that I call tax citizenship, and two, I made it impossible to lose it without certain steps, which generally speaking are notification. So, I mean, I certainly would invite somebody who believes they committed a relinquishing act prior to 2004 to consider the possibility that they're maybe not a U.S. citizen at all. Perhaps self-certify, perhaps actually apply for a CLN, but that's a different sort of issue. Anyway.
Well, here's a question, John. Excuse me. Here's a question, John. Would serving in your country's military or taking a position in your country's government be considered a relinquishing act?
Well, I don't know. I mean, first of all, for it to be a relinquishing act, Supreme Court of the United States has held that the act itself is not enough. It has to be accompanied by the intention to relinquish U.S. citizenship, number one. Number two, there are certain, you know, when it comes to military service and that, there are certain kinds of military service or government service that come with a presumption of intent to lose U.S. citizenship, and others not so much. So The answer is, I don't know. You know, this is something that has to be sort of considered on an individual basis. But, you know, as I've been saying for years, the first step in defending yourself from the accusation of U.S. citizenship is to respond that you're not a U.S. citizen. And here are the reasons. And certainly, you know, over the years, I've done a very large number of self-certifications for people in a FACA context. But in any case, you know, I think that that's extremely important here because, you know, so people are threatened by bank account closures. Many of them feel the need to have a CLN. And it is possible in some cases, I believe, to get a CLN based on a past relinquishing act. And depending on the date, that could be enormously helpful to you. But again, this is all in the context of these threatened bank account closures. So let's talk about how to respond to this as a problem here. So let's say that somebody gets a letter from a bank and, you know, and all of a sudden, they're accused of being Americans. The first they've heard of it, they're 35 years old. It never occurred to them they were American. What would be the, and this is understandably upsetting to them in most cases. Anthony, what would you advise that person to do? They call you up, they're upset. My God, Anthony, I found you online. I saw that great show you did with the guy in Poland. I've been... love all your YouTube videos, and I need help. What would you advise me to do? I'm going out of my mind here. I can't sleep at night. I used to be able to sleep when I was only a French citizen, but the thought of dual citizenship, U.S. citizenship, upsets me. What should I do?
You know, the type of person that we're going to get is a person who does sort of want to keep their U.S. citizenship, but they found out, they're surprised. But, okay, I'm surprised. I still didn't know. And by the way, we'll even have people who will think because they moved overseas and got another citizenship, you know, as an adult, that by default they were no longer U.S. persons. And so now they're sort of confronted with the decision, well, maybe it's a good idea to have a U.S. passport. And so those are generally more the people that we will take on as clients. The people who still see the value in maintaining U.S. persons, you know, as a part of percentage, it's a very small percentage of our clients who actually do go through where, and the thing is as a tax attorney, I do have to advise compliance. And that's really the only thing we do. If someone's calling us to not comply, then there's really not a role for us, right? So everybody who comes in, it's like, okay, we're going to comply, and then we're going to go run it through this way. I've certainly have talked to a plenty of people where they didn't really see the benefit of complying because what's the sense? They had nothing in the U.S., no ties with the U.S., no reason ever to go back. So it becomes a point of, well, I don't think they're going to catch me. And now they're just sort of stuck with the, you know, now the other part is that, well, their bank account. Now what do you have to do? And so now we're seeing people trying to figure out, you know, like, all right, well, maybe I do have to do something.
Wouldn't these be mostly people with U.S. Social Security numbers already?
I am trying to think about that. And I'm thinking that most, yeah, you know what? I think nearly everybody that we've had, right, has, and I think maybe two people we have had over the years hadn't had Social Security numbers. But mostly everybody already does of the people who call us. Yeah.
So their situation, at least, is administratively perhaps more simple. But I'm glad that you make the point that there are a lot of people, well, there are people, okay, who are pleasantly surprised to learn they're U.S. citizens. You know, they see it as an opportunity. And then, I mean, there are people like that. And, you know, interestingly, I mean, people will pay millions of dollars, you know, for a second citizenship. And what's interesting to me is that these accidentals, if they are, in fact, American citizens, are actually able to get U.S. citizenship if they want it by basically just doing a streamlined filing for 3 years, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and then they're in compliance. They can have a U.S. passport. I mean, there are people who will see that of value. You know, there are plenty of people who don't, but I think it's important to note that there are a lot of people who would see that of value. You would agree with that?
Yeah, I do. And I mean, here's really the problem that we're running into. And I just got off with a client who, lives in a country where the exchange rate isn't the greatest. And, you know, he saw our bill for, you know, doing his corporate work, his 5471. He's like, wow. I'm like, yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a little rough. So when, you know, whatever, you know, for sort of the perspective of us, you can't really say that's the cost. You have to give it a multiple. And now it really starts to get absurd when you have someone who, okay, this is a really complicated 5471 and you're charging them $5,000, which is what it was. But where they're living, it's like, no, that's more like $20,000 and they're middle class. Oh, and by the way, this is all so he can get a refund of $2,600. There's no tax that's going to be due to the United States government whatsoever. And so here's somebody who was thinking about, nah, I think I keep my U.S. passport. Well, you know what? The invoice from us right now is like, yeah, this is going to kind of, and I'm, you know, we're pretty decent on our billing and it's still really, really expensive. So now you got to think, it's like, well, why am I going to pay $20,000, you know, the equivalent of $20,000 every year to get a refund? This doesn't make any sense. And, you know, people are living on, you know, they just don't have the U.S. tax compliance industry is built around the U.S. and, around the world. Not only is it expensive as it is, it gets really expensive when you take into account what their standard of living is in the country that they're at.
Right. I think also you need to keep in mind when you're dealing with moving forward, if somebody wants to keep their U.S. citizenship, it's not just about the U.S. tax compliance costs moving forward. It's also how are they going to be able to live a normal life in their country of residence moving forward? Because if they acknowledge that they are a U.S. citizen, they are closed out of many of the financial products that could benefit them in their country of residence. So that's another aspect to keep in mind when taking a look at what is the future value of maintaining one's U.S. citizenship.
Yeah, I would call that the opportunity cost. I think I agree that the opportunity cost of this is, I think in many cases, even worse than the compliance cost. But, I know this is a horribly general question for you, Keith, but I mean, could you give some examples of things that people are shut out of?
Well, the basic thing is shut out of various types of financial products. Like in France, they can be shut out of a savings retirement product called assurance vie. They can be shut out of certain retirement products. They can be shut out of certain mutual funds. They can even be shut out of getting a mortgage. So we're talking some very basic financial products for them to take advantage of if they were just, and I'm only using France as an example, it could be any country, but where they're just a French citizen versus a French citizen who happens to be acknowledging their American citizenship as well. I know for me, the majority of the accidental Americans with whom I deal, the majority do not want their U.S. citizenship. They don't identify as Americans.
Okay, before we move on to that group, which is sort of the main event here, just adding to what you said there, Keith, and you know, inviting Anthony to add anything that he wants. But on the issue of the financial products they're shut out of, I think this is largely driven by the kind of tax treaty that the United States has with another country.
Well, I think it's also driven by FATCA as well, that banks are very leery about having anybody with, as I like to call it, a U.S. taint. They just don't want to take the risk of any type of penalty or any compliance costs that these banks do that would have. So they would just say, nope, we're not accepting you whatsoever.
Yeah, I would agree with Keith on that. That's the real driver behind people getting their losing, you know, their life insurance policies, their mutual funds, is because they are a U.S. person, and just the U.S. financial industry just doesn't want to be bothered. They just don't want to be bothered, and they're fine discarding the few people that are overseas, or not
well,
even
not
the
only,
U.S. So the U.S. are fine, but
yeah.
I'm saying the four. Right. I'm sorry. Right. The foreign financial institution just doesn't want to be bothered. Is it overkill? Probably, but can you blame them? You know.
No, I don't think you can blame them at all. I mean, I think that this is, you know, an absolutely obscene intrusion into the, you know, the financial structure of other countries and the residents of those countries. I don't think there's any two ways about it. But, you know, what's clear from what both of you are saying, and I do agree, is that it is extremely difficult to live outside the United States as a tax resident of another country, be in compliance with the U.S. tax laws, and do any kind of reasonable, you know, retirement financial planning. You know, very difficult. And this is why, you know, people are renouncing. I don't think they're renouncing because they want to. I think they're renouncing pretty much because they have to. At this point, unless they have an incredibly, incredibly simple financial life. You know, my opinion I have on this, and I emphasize this is an opinion, is this, that long run, I think the only way that Americans can keep their citizenship, be tax compliant, and live outside the United States is if they learn to do their own taxes. And do either of you have any particular thoughts on that?
Wait, to do their own taxes? I mean, that's a wow. If you are incredibly competent and have a model of what exactly needs to be filed each year, sure, because, I mean, the problem with when you file is now the IRS knows about you. And with foreign returns, you have some crazy things and forms that are required. And so you're alerting the IRS that you exist and the possibility that you have some additional forms required. And by the way, the IRS may or may not incorrectly assess you these penalties that you may or may not be able to fight back on. So,
and you have to also have a very simple financial profile.
Oh, God, yeah. I would say filing your own return as a U.S. person overseas is one of the riskiest things you can do. I mean, you got to be real, real careful or be
right.
completely judgment-proof. You know, that's one way. But then if you're completely
exactly.
judgment-proof, why even, I mean, can't really say not to file, but trying to see why what the benefit of filing is.
It's less of an issue.
Well, also,
I mean, if you have nothing, it's less of an issue, obviously.
Right, but also there's another element to keep in mind is, and I'm focusing right at the with this statement on the accidental American situation, is that you have a lot of accidental Americans who do not speak, read, or write English. And even
yeah.
when they have a simple financial profile, they cannot have, they do not have the ability to go through these tax forms. Even as
okay.
a native English speaker, it's very difficult.
Exactly. That's what I was exactly going to say. There's a lot of people in North America who can't understand them either. I mean, I think that when it comes to understanding the U.S. tax system, it's actually equal opportunity confusion. Nobody can understand it. You know, I think this is very much demonstrated by this 3520 penalty brouhaha that's, you know, that's going on right now. That's been, you know, written about at tax connections and that sort of thing. Let's move on to the, you know, the whole accidental American thing, where we presume that, you know, the worst thing that could happen to them is to be accused of being American. They don't want to be American. And that, you know, they disregard this as a huge, huge problem. So let's talk about some options here. Keith, you know, people frozen
yes.
in fear, frozen in fear. Somebody calls you up frozen in fear. What would you tell somebody frozen in fear?
Oh, I think it depends on their situation. And I usually the frozen in fear is 9 times out of 10, they get the famous FACTA letter from their bank and the bank is threatening to close their account if they don't have a CLN to present or a social security number. Now, the de rigueur, if you will, the standard practice, which has been for the past few years, are these accidental Americans to actually obtain a social security number from the United States for the sole purpose.
Just a sec. Let's get to that in a minute, okay?
Okay.
Anthony, do you think that there are people, at least when they're frozen in the moment of fear, where maybe what they should do is, well, do nothing at all until they think this through and feel it through?
Yeah, that's sort of a hard question for me to answer, as I always have to advise compliance. Keith wants to answer this question.
I think it depends on the bank situation, because I've dealt with people who have done nothing when they've received their FATCA letter, and they have received no follow-up FATCA letter from their bank, and it's just gone away. I've also dealt with people who have self-certified on their own and sent in their self-certification that they've outlined, and the bank has accepted it, and it's gone away.
Okay.
But I've also dealt with people who...
Now, Keith, let's not get ahead of ourselves here, okay? Because it seems to me that these are all sort of different issues, and I want to segment this off so that they're seen as different issues. So, first of all, I mean, I think that Anthony would agree, all right, that, you know, to wait a week or two to figure it out is not to fall into willful noncompliance. You would agree with that.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got to do your research. And, you know, and to echo Keith's point, which is truly obnoxious, your task compliance is a non-delegable duty. Okay, that's the way the code looks at it, that you can't say, hey, look, I'm not responsible for what this mistake on this return because I hired this very competent tax preparer. That doesn't work. Now, maybe they'll abate it, but maybe not, because, well, you're responsible for hiring the tax preparer. But when you're dealing with somebody whose English is not their first language, unless it's Spanish, there are zero documents from the IRS in your own native language. And so now you're stuck with, like, well, I guess I could hire a certified translator to translate it for me, but you're still in the same position because now you're relying on someone else. And so it's this absurd system where we have global taxation, but we won't speak the global language. We've refused to speak the global languages. Rather, you must speak, you know, the language in the U.S. And by the way, you know, just because you speak English, it doesn't mean it's U.S. English, right? Our words differ around the globe. So there is just an absurdity that drives me nuts. If you want global taxation, then put the tax code in every friggin' language. That's what you need to do.
The tax code or the IRS?
Everything. It all has to be in a foreign language. If you say that compliance is a non-delegable duty, that means the person has to be able to understand it and not rely on somebody else. But by definition, they have to rely on somebody else because it's not in their language.
Well, Anthony, don't you think a better solution might be for the United States, as well as decreeing FACA, to simply decree that English is the only language that can be spoken in the world?
I think that'd make it a lot simpler, wouldn't it? Yeah.
I think
it could and make it official, right?
Yeah, and not only English, but we'll call it IRS English.
Right, which is different than any other English. You have to speak IRS East, right? Yeah.
IRS East, I like
that. There you
that.
Go. That is like now that. The official language. That is probably, you know what, that is probably the subject matter of somebody's dystopian science fiction novel. Yeah, it probably will be the truth at some point, right?
Well, I think that actually we may very well be there. I mean, there are many people looking at what's going on today who would say that Orwell was an optimist. Remember in 1984, we had the new language newspeak, and maybe we make it IRS speak.
It is right. It is the ultimate language, right?
In fact, you know, what I'm finding in the 21st century, you know, it used to be the single most interesting, you know, you went to a cocktail party and people would talk about where their kids were going to school, or their new swimming pool. Now everybody just talks about where somebody's a tax resident. the new world, it's just all about taxation.
Yes, it always has been, I think. And now we're just sort of a bit more, you know, out in the open about it.
So let's say somebody, you know, is just so frozen in fear they can't do anything. You know, and I've seen this. So the worst case happens, I suppose, their information eventually finds its way to the IRS, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, all right. So I guess, I mean, this is sort of, you know, when we talk about something that's so, you know, the tax code is so large, it can't be administered. The IRS has, I subscribe to the news list about the latest report and about how the IRS can't, you know, keep track of, you know, there's fraudulent loss carryforwards, fraudulent credits, money going left and right. And so the IRS can't even keep track of the domestic I mean, they're so far away from having a handle on the things that happen within the borders. So far away. And now, well, and now it's like, well, that's not enough. Now we want to administer things that are outside our geographical borders. And it's really, really absurd to think that they have the ability to do that. Now, they do have the ability to sort of do drive-by shootings to randomly hurt someone. But on a mass scale to properly administrate this, they're so far away from having that ability. It's kind of laughable. So when, you know, when people ask, it's like, here, by the way, here's all this FATCA information. And this is stuff that has come out through the hearings and things that we have found out. Where does this information go? And the answer is nobody knows. And I talked to many IRS examiners. I'm like, hey, how many audits have you guys initiated? Number one, for FBARs. The answer on that is zero. How many audits have you initiated based on information gleaned from FATCA? And they're still, I haven't heard of anything yet. Now, we have had audits initiated as part of information sharing that came from other countries. There was an Iceland bank that got information to the IRS over their credit cards, and the Swiss have been sharing information to the IRS and the Department of Justice of various bank accounts, but that is actually independent of FATCA. They didn't need to do FATCA for that information sharing. So the question is, you know, for all, let's say, all the FATCA information they glean from the UK, what are they doing with that? And I don't see it. So the answer, what the IRS is doing, it's, I don't know. Maybe at some point they'll get to it. And the other thing too is the IRS doesn't have the examiners to do this. They are so far away from having this. And this is a true story. I talked to a group manager at one of the field offices, like, hey, so how is the international returns going? And she goes, oh, it's really bad. I was like, well, why is that? She goes, well, half of my auditors refuse to work on them. I said, why is that? She says this, because they're too complicated. Right there. And now you say, well, why doesn't the group manager just fire the people who refuse to work? Well, because there's not going to be any hires, and she still needs them to work on domestic stuff. So the fact is, we have a tax system that IRS examiners themselves refuse to work on because it's too complicated. Yep, we're running around, and the IRS is running around acting like it can actually enforce this thing. But the only thing it can do is rule by fear and intimidation. And certainly, there are people who get hammered, and when they get hammered, it gets hard. And that's really the motivation for a lot of people to sort of use some disclosure program or to be in compliance.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we, since you mentioned that, why don't we talk about the disclosure programs a little bit here?
Now, yeah, well, I would say this, and I would say, you know, and I I've been looking at the IRS relief procedures, and, you know, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, to me, it comes down to one question.
Okay, how so much discretion? Relief procedures, you mean the ones that came out last week?
Right. This is the relief procedures for certain former Americans. Okay. So whether this is a good idea, the merits, I don't want to get to. This is my fundamental question, because this is the difference that I've seen. Is there going to be some sort of discretion of some IRS examiner when you submit this? Or is this something that's just going to kind of go in, be processed, and there's no talking to? Because here's the difference. If this is something that is, you just file it and it gets processed, okay, well, I'm going to say, okay, that's like the streamline process. Okay, the streamline process is pretty good. We haven't had problems with it. Okay, the complete disaster, and I mean disaster, and the IRS should be full of shame for what they did, is what they did in the offshore voluntary disclosure program. It was absolutely correct. Disgusting what they did. They really, really angered me because, oh yeah, you got to do this, otherwise we're going to do this and this. And so we would have people coming forward like, okay, I want to come clean and do the right thing. So the people who came forward the quickest and the soonest to say, oh my God, I have a problem. You know what? They were the people who got hammered the hardest. And we're looking for relief for these people. And the IRS is looking to hammer them again and again. It's like, hey, yeah, client, you know what? If you just waited, you would have gotten a better deal. And the IRS hasn't accepted responsibility for their completely asinine behavior. I don't trust them. I don't trust the discretion of this, because they start to look at people as targets. And they don't look at them as individuals. Oh, yeah, here's a guy who lives in Switzerland and he's got $1 million in his bank account. Oh, yeah, you know what? Let's kind of ruin him, right? Yeah, he's 70 years old. Let's ruin him, right? There's nothing wrong with that. It's like, right, well, what did he do wrong? Okay, maybe he missed like $10,000 of taxes and didn't file some friggin' forms. And you think it's okay to ruin this person. You think it's okay. And we have people who, you know, they have to hire us. And we're not exactly cheap. And we have to fight tooth and nail. And the lack of humanity is just disgusting. I don't know what boot camp they send these examiners to, but something happens to you, man. You leave a part of your soul behind. It's just disgusting. And I would advise anyone, man, if you want a good life, don't work for the IRS, because you're going to do some dirty work, man. And that's going to go to your soul. And you're not going to get rid of that.
You believe in reincarnation, Anthony.
Well, I wonder what they did in a past life to come back as an IRS examiner. You did something pretty nasty. I'm going to say that.
Well, Anthony, don't you see? Excuse me, Anthony, don't you feel that they ruin certain individuals overseas because, as you, to use your term before, they use it as a drive-by shooting, but the fear of God in other people
exactly.
for them to come
that's
into
exactly,
compliance?
That's exactly what's going on, because they don't have the ability to administer this correctly and fairly. They administer it unfairly. Every court decision you see, you know, you'll see these press releases where they're so proud. They're so proud. Here's a retired chiropractor that we hammered with a $2 million FBAR penalty. And you're like, and you think that's a good thing. It's like, well, what did he do? Like, did he kill someone? Was he like a murderer? Or did he run a criminal conspiracy? Oh, no, he just didn't report some taxes. And you're ruining the man. And, yeah. and you're bragging about this. And the courts, of course, are ratifying it because, you know, if it's taxes and you, hey, look, in law school, if you wanted to turn off a group of attorneys or budding attorneys as quick as you can, you start talking about taxes. Attorneys don't want to get into it. And the same with judges. Yet taxes are the most consequential thing we have. Yet they're sort of ignored because it's complicated and involves a lot of statute reading and people don't want to get into that. So,
Anthony, don't you realize that in the United States today, you can get a more significant period of incarceration for failing to file an FBAR than for killing somebody?
That is true. That is absolutely true.
I mean, what does that say about a country's mindset and legal system?
You don't really have a system. I wouldn't call it a legal system. I would call it a criminal a criminal justice system with sort of like criminal italicized. It's criminal what our legal system is and how it operates. And especially in the area of taxation, because how they have to work is so extreme so that they, you know, so I mean, their whole point is so that these people overseas do not sleep at night, because it could be you. It could be you. Now, there's no way they can get, you know, the 8 million overseas. There's no friggin' way. I mean, what's the entire U.S. government's capacity? I think that in prison is something like 200,000 inmates or something like that total.
We're the highest incarceration
rate. Right, we have the highest incarceration rate, which is just fantastic. But there's certainly not enough room. I mean, so far away. And, you know, the thing about this. There's only the Department of Justice can only process about 3,000 tax evasion indictments a year. Most of those, 92% of those, about 92% of those are all plea bargains. So, I mean, one simple way to shut down the whole system is for everybody to say, yeah, I'm not taking a deal. Let's go to trial. You know, that's one way. They could not. You would shut the system down. But they're really good at sort of getting that fear equation just right to say, well, we'll sort of like really scare people. And then when it's your ass, you know, when it's really you up there talking to the judge, you know, a lot of this stuff is easy in theory, but when it's you sort of being processed, being dragged into federal court, maybe they indicted your spouse to put a little extra pressure.
Yeah,
on
but
you.
Aren't we,
it's different.
But aren't we talking about people who the Department of Justice is going to go after? When there's a high rate return of an investment, if you will,
yeah.
they're
yeah.
not going to go after the small fries and take and use all those resources.
Well,
to do
that's
that.
not quite true, because the IRS, they want the right size fish, which tends to be a little smaller, because all they're looking for is a press release. They don't give a shit about what they don't care about what they are collecting. They really don't. All they need is a press release to say, oh, here's somebody who shortchanged us $1 million. Well, that's really easy number to get up to if someone hasn't filed in 10 years, because you can say, okay, if this person had $100,000 worth of income each year and you throw in your self-employment taxes, you know, that's $20,000 a year they owe. You throw in your penalties and interest, and, you know, you're rounding that up pretty good for somebody who's a middle-class person. who hasn't filed in 10 years, they could get a tax debt, $500,000, maybe more. And that's all they really want, because then the government's going to put an order for restitution on that, for that, whatever that is. And by the way, there's no process to collect on the restitution. There's none. There's zero. You actually have to go and like, hey, clerk, I have restitution. They're going to be like, what? You do? Hold on. Let's take a look. Hey, we can't find it. It'll take you 15 minutes to find where your restitution order is. There's no processing of that. And the simple thing is they don't care, because they don't need the money. What they need is you to be scared absolutely crazy that it might be you next.
Okay, but in fairness here, you know, coming back to the issue of accidental Americans, first of all, it seems to me that there is no chance of this group of people who didn't even know they were citizens falling into this category. Secondly, I'm not aware of any Americans abroad who've been, you know, dealt with in this way. And I suspect that that's unlikely. And thirdly, remember, Anthony, who's the biggest victim of citizenship taxation?
The IRS.
Absolutely.
Right.
So, you know, we should remember that. But, okay. So on this particular program, all right, that was introduced a week or so ago, let's get into what this actually is. And let's begin with who cannot use it. Okay, either one of you want to comment on that? Who is absolutely prohibited from using this program?
Who is prohibited from using the program?
Yeah, so in other words, the program is designed to interest people who renounced and never filed anything, or who do want to renounce and find an easy way to, you know, clean up the tax stuff, right? So the first group who cannot use this would be anybody who's ever filed a 1040, right?
Correct.
Right.
You have to have no filing, and even a 1040 NR, I did see
just
that.
No filing.
That's no filing. Yep. Yep.
No. Well, actually, how do we know? Because we're early into it. But the IRA FAQs did say that if somebody filed a 1040 NR because they didn't know they were a U.S. citizen, they could use the program.
Okay, so I think it's like, well, what if they knew? I know I'm a citizen, but I'm filing a 1040 NR. Now we get into this.
That's an issue regarding. So first of all, you can't have filed a 1040. Secondly, there's a stipulation on your net worth, and that would be what?
You can't have your net worth has to be less than $2 million.
$2 million, both at the time of renunciation and at the time of filing, I think.
And that could be a difference. There could be a difference, and there really could be.
There surely could be. That's particularly since all this is done, you know, in U.S. dollars and exchange rates fluctuate.
Yep.
The third stipulation has to do with the amount of tax owing. So, and that is, I believe, it's $25,000 or under, or let's say under $25,000 in what really amounts to 6 years: the 5 years prior to the year of renunciation and the year of renunciation.
And you know, as I read that, it's like, well, do they mean you have to have a total tax liability per year, or do they mean in total?
No, it's cumulative. It's definitely.
Yeah, and that's a pretty easy. Now, this is what I don't like about it. It's like, well, now you're making us, you know, for us to get to the answer, we have to now file 5 years of taxes to figure out if that $25,000 or less has been met, as opposed to sort of having something a little bit simpler. You know, that's the thing. The IRS wants to sort of like, oh, we want to have a program, but we don't want to give anything away here. They don't want to give anything away because, you know, and just generally, I mean, we probably would sort of save this for the end, but, you know, this isn't the greatest deal in the world because these aren't people the IRS can really do a lot with anyway.
Yeah, but it does help. Well, actually, nothing is the greatest deal in the world from the IRS, but it does seem to me that this program is a benefit to certain groups of people, and I'll give my thoughts on who, and then you can agree, disagree, or add more. The first group is obviously those who can't sleep at night because they renounced without filing taxes. You know, and there are a lot of people like that, and you know, if it's therapeutic for them to deal with it, you know, why not? Because ultimately, this is about, you know, moving individuals forward. A second group of people, in theory, okay, because remember that renouncing without filing would make you a covered expatriate, would be those who would be concerned about being a covered expatriate from the point of view of bequests made to U.S. citizen children. Now, that's a group who might want to consider it. And a third group would be those who want to clean up their tax situation without having a Social Security number. Because interestingly, this program clearly states that a Social Security number is not required to use the program. And that is, you know, hugely beneficial to the group of people who, you know, want to renounce and want to be in tax compliance. Keith, do you share those views of mine, or do you think that there are no benefits to this, or do you disagree with any of the specific ones I've suggested?
I guess that question is that question posed to me or Anthony?
Both of you.
Let me just go ahead and speak. I think it's going to be, each case is going to have to be weighted on its own merits. As far as retroactively entering the U.S. tax system after one has already renounced. I think it depends. It's going to depend on their situation. But please keep in mind that we cannot look at this just within the U.S. bubble. Because, for example, there are countries' tax authorities who will protect that particular individual who happens to be a citizen of that country. They will not do the IRS bidding. France is one example of that. So there's really no reason or benefit for the accidental American who has obtained a CLN without entering the U.S. tax system to all of a sudden retroactively enter the U.S. tax system. They're going to be quite reticent in doing that because they're not going to want to be on the IRS radar, and they know full well that they have the protection of their country's tax authority.
Yeah, I think those are very good points. What do you think, Anthony? Are there benefits to this program? Why would somebody – well, I mean, let's break it down.
Now, I'm only speaking retroactively.
The reasons I gave were prospective. Retroactively, that's a difficult question. I think that's largely based on, you know, does somebody need it just for sort of emotional closure? What do you think, Anthony? Are there benefits to doing this retroactively? Are there benefits to doing it prospectively? And
I would say, you know, retroactively, I'm not entirely sure on that. Prospectively, I could see somebody wanting to do it. Now, it's just that, you know, here's really my problem with it, and kind of, you know, I'm just seeing it from the taxpayer's perspective. If you meet these criteria, right, it's because you don't make a lot of money, right? It's because you don't have a ton of assets. Yet, you know, what you run into in order to do things correctly with the IRS, it's really not a function of how much you make. It really is not a function of your assets. It's just a function of what you have. You know, depending if, you know, if you have a foreign pension or if you have a business, you know, and then you have to do 5 years of tax prep to figure out. Now, maybe you don't have to do some informational returns. I'm not entirely sure what they want there, but you do have to certify an 8854. So yeah, that is required. So you're giving this, here's a great program for people who, you know, just don't make a lot of money. And it's really expensive. So that's kind of the whole, and the thing is, if you do it yourself, that's not a good idea. That's just not a good idea.
That's sort of my
jaundiced view on it. If you really wanted to help people who didn't have all the money in the world, I think you would do something differently. Now, will people do that? And I mean, we're trying to get our costs lower all the time, but there's just, you know, the IRS just does not make it easy for any of them.
No, they don't. I mean, it's just, very expensive.
I would say I'm just more, I guess my first reaction was just, you know, rolling my eyes because it's not what I want to see. But is it better than nothing? Yeah, it's better than nothing.
Is it better than a streamline for somebody below $2 million?
Well, I don't know. And I think you would want, I mean, I'm not entirely sure. Because my question is, well, what if somebody had, if they just go through this straight, will they be penalized if they had late 5471s? Does that take care of all penalties? Is there a 0% penalty, or can the IRS come back and say, hey, we want to penalize you for some stuff? So my question, what we're looking into is this, you know, using a streamlined and I think that's something we talked about, using the streamlined and the relief procedures. That I would always want to take a look into that first. Because if you are overseas, there's a 0% penalty with the streamline. So that's pretty nice. And the process isn't bad. You know, that I could say the streamlines have been, you know, night and day difference between the OVDP. We're able to sort of get a good idea of how long it's going to take, give people a good idea of the cost.
OVDP is, it's a nasty history, but it is history. So I don't think we need to worry about that. I also doubt my reading of the information coming out of the IRS so far is that there will be no penalties on this as long as it's not willful. By the way, here's a
question. And I mean, now then, I guess this is a thing. So I guess is so you. I guess can you be willful, right? And then use this because I mean, their documents they say that they state. You know, is the 8854, which includes, because in 8854, you don't actually need to file 5 years. You need 5 years of compliance, which could be different. So that's kind of the thing I would want to look at is what is 5 years of compliance mean?
Right. Gentlemen, I need to ask a question because you two are the tax experts. I'm a layman, even though I'm pretty savvy in a number of different areas.
Especially at the IRS, especially in the government, right. There are no tax experts in this world.
Well, let me just throw out this question for clarity. With this new IRS program, okay, there are no penalties, but if there are any taxes owed, provided that one is below the threshold to meet this new program, there are no taxes owed. You're exempt. Is that correct? Under this new IRS program. So follow me. So follow me on this. If that's correct, then on the streamlined program, there's no penalties, but if there are taxes owed, you do have to pay those taxes. Is that correct?
You sound like a tax expert.
So this new IRS program is more beneficial to a certain number of accidental Americans to be part of than doing the streamlined program.
Well, here is the difference that you might, and here's something that could come into it. When we talk about, you know, that a lot of times it's not the taxes that's the worry, it's the tax compliance, doing the tax returns, they get really onerous. With the streamlined, you're 3 years and done. There is 5 years that you have to do. So it's something where, okay, well, this will cost me more in tax prep, but there'll be no taxes due. And that would be this program, whereas with the streamline, I won't have as much to pay in tax prep, but there's less taxes due. So I could kind of see that sort of calculus right going on right there.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But I wouldn't underestimate the value of not having to have a Social Security number. To take advantage of this new program. I think that there are, for certain types of people, I think there's clear benefits to this program. Before I forget this, I got an email from somebody a day or two ago just talking about the evolution of this stuff. And this is just shocking, shocking. So the person went into OVDI in 2011, you know, when the IRS was saying, this is your last best chance to come into compliance. Those who come into compliance now will pay less. Well, she did that. The streamline came along, of course, and people paid less. But then in 2014, a better streamline came along and people paid less. Now they have this where people will pay far less. I mean, they might pay nothing, but the reason she gave me this message was because she paid all this money in OVDI, and she was hit up with the transition tax in a fairly significant way. And what she said to me was that if she had done nothing and taken advantage of this new procedure, she and her husband would pay no U.S. taxes and would be renounced. And, you know, she's extremely angry because she feels betrayed, you know, that basically she tried to do the right thing by coming into compliance early. And look at what that got her. Yeah. You know, the people who delayed have done a lot better. Do you think, Anthony, things will get even more generous? Do you think at some point the IRS will throw up their hands and say, well, you know, that's it. Anybody who's been out of the United States for more than 20 years, we don't want to hear from you anymore.
No, I don't think that's really realistic. The IRS never likes to give up a thing. You know, they really don't. They only give up something when they think they're going to lose it anyway. So I don't see them doing that. They always like that. They always like to have ammunition, because if you think about it this way, it's like, you know, it's like this. They go up against a taxpayer. The taxpayer sort of gives them a hard time. And I mean, they can be incredibly vindictive. And actually, that's actually the story of the one of the first large FBAR penalties of John McBride. You know, I talked to John and he told me what happened. He got really mad at the IRS examiner because the examiner could not understand that money was stolen from him. So he started saying, these guys stole my money. They have it. I don't know where it is. If I knew where it was, I'd have my money and I'd tell you where the bank account is. And so he got really chippy with the examiner. And the examiner says, okay, you're going to be a jerk like that? Well, here's this little thing called FBAR penalties. We're going to dust off the shelf and apply it to you. So it was one of the most grotesque applications of a law. And so that's generally what the IRS likes, is it always likes to have, you know, that they always like to have these arrows to destroy anybody they want to. So I would never see them sort of abandoning, you know, an arrow that they could have to destroy somebody they don't like.
You know, on the issue of FBARs, interestingly, the streamline does require 6 years of FBARs. This new program does not require FBARs. I'm not saying people shouldn't file FBARs, but it's interesting the program doesn't. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, right. That is really weird.
IRS weirdness.
Yeah, right. I mean, I get it. I mean, it actually is logical not to include it, but I don't know why they're being logical.
Title 31.
It's nothing to do with taxes, but so why are we being logical on this? You know, so yeah, that's kind of strange, and maybe we'll see an update on that. Like, so hey, we listened to John Richardson. He said we should really get these FBARs.
Oh my God, yeah.
Oh no.
What do you, Keith? Why do you think they came out with a program anyway? And before you answer, what I find interesting about it is that it applies to people who either have or want to renounce after March 18th, 2010, which is the advent of FACA. So clearly this is something to do with FACA, and this also seems to arise in the context of, you know, the uncomfortable situation of foreign banks saying, hey, what's going to happen? We can't get these Social Security numbers from people by the end of 2019. I see this as completely unrelated to helping accidental Americans, but completely related to improving the politics of the situation by helping the foreign banks. Do you agree or disagree?
Oh, partially agree. I do know for a fact that this program has come into fruition as a result of the French and Dutch delegations going to Washington and pushing back on the Department of Treasury as it pertains to their citizens who are accidental Americans, and most especially from France and from the hard work of Fabien Lahagre and his association of accidental Americans. This is a direct result of that.
Why don't we call it the Fabien program?
Yeah, well, then I'm going to like the program more then. Okay, then I'll like it more.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of hard work to get it. So,
Fabien program.
Yeah.
Exactly. And what's ironic with this program is that is it perfect? No. Does it help certain accidental Americans? Yes. But guess what? It also helps certain Americans overseas as well. And it's as a result of their singular focus on getting some type of relief/amnesty. And that is why this program has come into play.
You know what, Keith, that's a really good point. And you know that because, you know, we have a lot of people, we have to deal with negativity all the time saying nothing's going to change. We can at least say this is a change in a positive direction and maybe not be so negative on it. It's like, okay, here's a positive change we've actually seen as a part of some intense advocacy. And that's sort of the challenge that we always have is, you know, people say, look, this isn't going to change. It's like that ends up being a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I guess, yeah, it's look, somebody did get the IRS's attention. They really did. So, and Fabien did a great job. And I think, you know, the whole group, so we could at least count as a victory for a step in the right direction.
You know, this is more than an IRS change, because if you really, you know, read the stuff that came out, there's actually a joint statement from the State Department and the IRS. And, you know, because the State Department talks about the whole Social Security number thing and the IRS is talking about the taxes. And, you know, you can view that as good or bad. I see that as actually somewhat alarming, because it suggests to me that there may be sort of interaction and joint purpose coming from Treasury and state on these renunciations. And that, I think, would not be a good thing, particularly if, you know, it evolves into needing Social Security numbers to renounce or something. I mean, we're a long way from that, but I could imagine it coming.
Hey, John, I do have to get on another call right now, or pretty soon. And
what,
I think
do you have 3 minutes?
I have 3 minutes. I absolutely
right.
do.
What I'd like to do then in the 3 minutes is let's just, you know, we wrote down 6 options here for people.
Yep.
Okay. You know, we've been a bit all over the place. So let me just recap what these are. And these are not recommending any of these options. Okay. These are just logical options. The first is, at least for a while, you know, when you have your oh my God moment, you do have time to figure this out intelligently. And still be non-willful. You don't have to, you know, the next morning, you know, call Anthony and start filing U.S. taxes. The second option, logically, is, you know, the banks are asking for Social Security numbers. Well, that's fine. They can ask what they want, and, you know, maybe people will supply them, and maybe they won't, and who knows where that goes. Third option to either renounce or relinquish. And, you know, the IRS generously states in their information in relation to this new program is that people can renounce or relinquish without being tax compliant. And if the IRS says you can do it, I guess you can do it. So there must be people. Well, clearly, there are people who are renouncing or relinquishing without being tax compliant. And I would add to that that they may want to consider whether they could get a relinquishment prior to 2004.
Yeah, and I would say just quickly on that option, I would just say that, you know, and I think this is just generally true of everyone overseas, whether you're accidental American or not. When we're talking about criminal charges, that's really not you, okay? If you're overseas, I think that we found one case where somebody was overseas, but actually they just happened to be in Israel. They really weren't there for something that occurred in the U.S. If you do something in the U.S., go overseas, yeah, they're going to drag you back for that. But if you're living overseas and you're living as a, you know, in whatever country, as a citizen of that country, I guess in theory, the Department of Justice could drag you back. We've never seen it happen. And honestly, and this is really what you need to understand, the jury wouldn't understand why you're there. They're going to try to convict someone who the jury's like, wait, you have to pay taxes if you live overseas? What? They're going to be confused. So when we're talking about really the penalties, it's financial. You know, it's financial. Can you get a bank account? And is there going to be a risk of a penalty that they'll assess and also collect and, you know, maybe assess, but that collect is a big question mark. So that's really, you know, the reality of it. So, and I mean, if you are up at night, you know, oh my God, I'm going to be arrested, thrown in jail. Like, yeah, that maybe, but for something else, okay? For something else, you did not this. Yeah.
Well, yeah, so you're talking about, you know, for somebody who renounces relinquishment, doesn't file taxes, you know, I mean, I would agree with you that criminal stuff is not, I think, the issue. But, you know, it is possible to renounce or relinquish and deal with the tax situation. So a fourth option would be this new program that we've talked about today, if you're eligible for it. A fifth option would be take advantage of the streamlined, and these would be people who, in my judgment, would have over 2 million net worth and are perhaps entitled to the dual citizenship exemption, etc. A renounced streamlined. And the final option would be for that group of people that Anthony identified in the beginning, who are, you know, just simply overjoyed to learn they're Americans. What could be better? And, you know, for them, they can come into compliance and get a U.S. passport and live happily ever after, maybe as an American overseas. I think those are the options. And I think what you do depends on your individual circumstances.
That's very right. Yeah, there is no, and we've said this many times, there is no one size fit all. There's no hack to the system. You kind of really got to examine your unique situations and also what your goals are too. And that might differ than, you know, your goals could differ from your spouse too. So,
that's exactly. And I think, I think also, and I can't remember which option, that this is something to keep in mind if you are an accidental American, and John, you can explain this a bit better than I can, is that if you are a dual citizen since birth, then you're not going to have to pay an exit tax.
There's a little more to it than that. It's a necessary but not a sufficient condition. But okay. certainly that's, I mean, I think the point here is that people do need, I think, you know, decent counseling and analysis of their own situations. All right. Now, one final point that I would like to make here that was not made was this, that we talk about streamline versus this new program. Both of them require non-willfulness. There's a specific definition of non-willfulness for the streamline program. I'm not certain that that same definition is used for this new program, although it probably is. That is, and it may be out, I just don't know about it, but that I think is the missing piece of the puzzle. So there we go. Been a long, interesting session. Thank you for your insights on this. Keith, do you have, if you had to leave a message for the accidental Americans of the world before signing off today, what would the message from Keith Redmond be?
I would say, first, just breathe. Just don't do anything in haste. Think it through. And get all the information possible, and not just within the U.S. tax compliance industry, but outside the U.S. tax compliance industry as well. And to not make any hasty decisions and not make decisions out of fear, because you will only hurt yourself in the long run.
And what do you do if you're so scared you can't think? Then what?
I beg your pardon?
And what if you're too upset to think or think clearly? Then what do you do?
Go to YouTube, IRS Medic. That's what I'd say. I have a whole bunch of videos for you.
Talk to Anthony. Talk to me. Talk to you, and to just get some semblance of the reality on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's better to just wait and not do anything when you're upset. That's why I tell people all the time when I speak to them, just breathe. It doesn't have to be done yesterday. But each case, as Anthony said, each case has to be weighted on its own merits, and there is not a cookie-cutter approach to every single situation.
Anthony,
exactly. And I would say, yeah, Keith,
your advice, your parting advice today to the millions of accidental Americans in the world looking for guidance, what would be your advice on?
Well, and I could imagine a lot of people, I hear this a lot. People do not, they get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and this is what keeps them up. So here's something to think about. Think about it from the IRS's perspective, and think about sort of how limited they are. And I kind of mentioned some of those things in this podcast, sort of how limited they are. They really don't have the ability, go to sleep. Okay. They're not going to be knocking at your door. They're not going to be knocking at your door. Go to sleep. Okay. And you can think about it. And talk to us, talk to, other people feeling the same things, going through the same things. There is no panic. And if you are panicked, it's really something we try to make sure that we have people cool down, because people will be panicked and like, oh, I want to do this full, or they'll say, oh, I want to do the full offshore voluntary disclosure program. And we're like, please don't. That's not for you. That's overkill. You're going to hurt yourself. Think about it. And so luckily we're able, people get a cooling off period, like, oh, okay, I'm not the only one. And you're really not the only one. There's millions just like you. Millions. What can they possibly do with millions of people in noncompliance? And they're just really, and especially when you're overseas. So get some sleep, relax. You'll figure out a solution that will work for you.
Yeah, bearing in mind, I think that one of the problems, this is largely an emotional thing, and people crave certainty, and the people who crave the certainty most are the most likely to do the stupidest things. I think that there is no perfect solution here. A decision has to be made, but I think understanding what a decision is important. The only reason in life a decision is required is because you don't have certain options. That's the problem.
So don't be too hard on yourself. Just pick, you know, whatever option, you know, works better for you. There's no doubt that you're caught in the eye of an extremely unjust, immoral hurricane. You're not the one who's done anything wrong, believe me on this. I mean, the United States clearly, by having the audacity to impose worldwide taxation, according to U.S. tax rules, on people who are tax residents of other countries, is living in and administering a system that's sort of in a moral swamp. That said, it doesn't change the reality of it. But for God's sake, I mean, unless you clearly have been willful, believe me, you've done nothing wrong. All right, contact information. Anthony, you can find Anthony at irsmedic.com, and he's got a whole ton of YouTube videos that are great. The American Overseas Facebook group, okay, which
American called American Expatriates.
I am sorry. Yes. The American Expatriates Facebook group, Facebook.com groups, American Expatriates. And my name is John Richardson, and you can find me at citizenshipsolutions.ca, along with all kinds of writing on these issues over the years.
So and John, I must interject. John, I must interject also for Accidental Americans. Fabien has a group on Facebook, and it's the same thing. Just look up Accidental Americans, and for those Accidental Americans, they should join Fabien's group.
So that would be Facebook.com groups Accidental Americans. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and this, you know, Fabien has done such important work that today the new IRS program has been christened the Fabien program. as a tribute to all his great work. All right, any closing,
yes.
Any things you want to say? Otherwise, we can sign off for today. Anthony, thank you so much for participating. Any closing wise words?
I think he had to sign off.
Okay. Keith, any closing wise words?
Nope. Like I said, just breathe. That's
okay.
It.
And I'm not wise enough to have wise words. So thank you very much. And looking forward to getting this out to people. Thanks.
Thank you.